Greetings and welcome to the Library's Lead in the New Normal podcast. This is our fourth podcast of the second season. Our star-studded lineup of Beth Botan, assistant professor at Syracuse University's School of Information Studies, Mike Eisenberg, founding dean and faculty emeritus of the University of Washington's High School, and me, myself, and I, Dave Lankus, the Bowden Professor of Librarianship at the University of Texas at Austin. Thank you for listening to our Libraries Lead podcast. Please keep spreading the word. Send us feedback at info@librarieslead.org and review us on your favorite podcast app. And we are very grateful for our academic sponsors, the University of Texas High School and the Syracuse University High School. And as always, Ace Chicago Events doing an amazing job of audio production and making us sound like we almost know what we're talking about. Hi, Beth. Hi, Mike. Hey, Beth, can you please remind us why we're here?
Yeah, as we've been saying, the last 2 years have been hard on us all. And it seems like there are some life-altering, transformative changes taking place. We talk about various aspects of life, work, fun, and what are or might be the unique roles and opportunities for libraries and librarians to help people in this new normal. Our podcast runs approximately 1 hour and includes a what's up from each of us, a deeper dive into a main topic, and as always, we'll end with our awesome library thingies. So let's get right to it. Dave, what's up with you?
Well, this is my first full week in Austin, yeehaw, and it's interesting. So I'm in a lovely one-bedroom apartment and been trying to figure out where things are. But over the holiday, the school purchased a Oculus Quest 2, which is a VR headset owned by the Facebook mothership, which is an interesting set of foreshadowing. Yes. And I have to say, so I have a pretty long history with virtual reality. I was the lab manager of the virtual reality lab at Syracuse University in 1990, back in the day when none of this existed, but all the publicity and everything was exactly the same as now. And so for a couple of years, I peek in, where is it? That's funny. Oh, it's never going to happen. I put these things on and I'm like, we're here. It was amazing. You just put this on and you go from your one bedroom apartment to you're in the middle of the desert or you're on a mountain. And it's just been an incredible experience. I've spent at least an hour a night just sort of trying these different things and seeing what's happening. So I've been geeking out and no doubt selling my soul at the same time. But it's been a pretty, pretty amazing time for me. So there you go. How about you, Beth? What's up with you?
Well, I was thinking that in 1990, I was like in seventh grade, not running a research lab or anything. So sorry.
I was an undergraduate at the time. I want to be clear.
Okay. All right. That was not clear there. So yesterday was MLK Day, and a local news reporter in Huntsville reached out to my family because, of course, my grandparents knew Martin Luther King and my dad also, you know, has got to meet him a few times, and they wanted somebody local with a connection to tell a story. And my dad was out of town and my sister called me and we decided my hair was closer to being TV ready than hers. And so I got to give the interview. And in everything I ever hear about the civil rights story in Huntsville, it always focuses on my dad and my grandfather, which is appropriate, but it always really leaves my grandmother out. And she played these really significant roles in both the lawsuit and in protests on her own accord. And so I made sure in the interview to like give her name and include her in the story. And so, you know, you don't really have a lot of control of what the news is going to be like, you know, what the interview is actually going to look like once they are finishing editing it. But they had cut out every mention of any woman I'd given in the interview. And they also didn't use my credentials or say that I was a professor. And at some point when, you know, we were like negotiating, the interviewer asked me if I'd come down to the studio. And I was like, you know, it's like my day off and I am not about to have to get dressed and come down to the studio when you knew this was a holiday. Like every year, it's the same day. And if you truly cared about covering the story and really doing well, right? Like I have the return checks from Martin Luther King from when he came to talk in Huntsville. Like there are so many cool things I could share with them, you know, pictures of him in my grandpa's Cadillac. But like, if you tell me that morning, like one, I know you don't really care about this story that much, but then it just reminded me of like the erasure of women when we tell these stories and like whose testimony counts. And so, yeah, I've been thinking about that a little bit today. The interview went great. I think the story they told was just fine, but just noticing again that like the women got cut from the story and decredentialed sort of. So I've been thinking about that. That's what's up with me. Mike, what's up with you?
Well, first, Beth, I think you should tell us who your grandmother was and her name and we'll also put a reference in there on our website
related to this
episode. So please take my time for what's up and do that.
Yeah. So I'll tell you that my grandmother's name is Martha Adams Herford, and she was a part of the civil rights movement here in Huntsville, and they were working to get national attention around protests and trying to desegregate our community. And they really couldn't garner any attention. And so they decided some prominent women needed to be arrested in the community. And so my grandmother was the wife of a doctor, her along with her dear friend, Joan Cashin, and a student who had been arrested several times, Frances Sims, all went down to Walgreens to try to order a cheeseburger and a coffee. And instead of lunch, they got arrested. And my grandmother went to jail. All three of the women went to jail. And they were going to let my grandmother and Joan out, but they weren't going to let the student protester out. And so there was another kind of mini protest. The prominent women wouldn't leave without the student protester. And also during this time, my grandmother was 6 months pregnant. So I have a really great video of her actually getting escorted into jail. She's in this beautiful white coat and, you know, with a big pregnant belly. She's pregnant with her third child at the time. Joan Cashin had her daughter with her, Cheryl Cashin, who's a law professor at, I hate that I can't remember this right now, Yale, maybe somewhere very fancy like that, Georgetown maybe. And so her daughter was with her, and that was in April 12th of 1962 when they got arrested. And then the next year, my grandmother sued the Board of Education here in Huntsville. And so my dad became the first Black person in Alabama to desegregate schools. And, you know, one of the things I always think about, she's like, you know, well, I just knew nobody would ever hurt a kid. And so I felt like it was okay for us to take this risk. But 1 week later was the bombing in Birmingham after my dad desegregated schools. And so knowing that they had been followed for a week and the kind of, you know, my grandfather would answer the phone and pretend that he was a cop, you know, to kind of keep the family safe. And so just knowing the risk that she took to keep the civil rights movement going and how often overshadowed those stories are. We celebrate folks like Rosa Parks, who should be celebrated, but also there are local heroes in all of our communities. And it's important that we like get to know who did this work where we live and start celebrating them. You know, give these ladies their flowers while they're still here.
Absolutely. That's great. So that's what's up with me.
So, yeah. Can I take mine back?
Cool.
No.
I'm cool with that. I told you, Dave, we're in a lot of trouble hanging out with Beth. She puts us all to shame. And that's great. All right. Well, let's take a very short break to take a deep breath and to just appreciate that for a minute. And when we come back, we will get on to our main topic, which is Facebook. I'm calling it the good, bad, and the ugly. So we'll be ready for a rock and rolling conversation in just a few minutes. So Yanni, music if you will, sir. Okay, and welcome back. Thank you for joining us in Let Libraries Lead in the New Normal. This episode tonight continues our conversation about social media. In our last episode, number 15, we talked about the big picture of social media, the what, why, and how, and also some of the behavioral and social and political issues around social media. Now we really want to zero in on the 800-pound gorilla. Actually, make that the 1.6 billion-pound gorilla with a B, because there's well over 1.6 billion people on average who visit Facebook every day. Let that just sink in a minute. That's just under a quarter of the entire world's population checking in, wow. About equal to the entire population of North America, South America, and Europe combined. Also, Facebook has about 2.9 billion monthly active users, and there are about a little less than 8 billion people on the planet. So that's almost 40% of the entire world every month. Interestingly, we don't think about it because we're a North American-centric kind of folks, but only 10% of Facebook users come from the United States and Canada. But 81% of Americans have Facebook accounts, and almost three quarters of them are regular users. India leads the world in total Facebook users with 290 million users. That's approximately 22% of India's total population of 1.4 billion. And what does that translate that to in terms of money? Because you may not be aware of it, but 93% of social media marketers worldwide use Facebook ads. That really means everyone. Anybody selling online uses Facebook. Facebook ad revenue in 2021 was over $100 billion. $100 billion. And that's up over 25% from the year before. And the profit on that, when I kind of calculate, it seems like it's likely to be well over 30% of that. So that's over $30 billion in profit just from the ad side of Facebook alone. I could go on, but I think you get the point. Facebook is huge. It's humongous. It's overwhelming. If it was a country, it would be bigger than China. It is ubiquitous, pervasive, persuasive, and hugely profitable. 400 users sign up to Facebook every minute in 2021. In that same minute, more than 500,000 comments are made. And there are almost 300,000 status updates, 130,000 photos uploaded. And get this, over 4 million posts are liked every minute. Facebook hasn't been around forever. It's only been around for about 18 years. It has a birthday in February. It started in 2004. So, with all of this, which gets my stomach churning pretty well, what does it all mean for our society? What is going on with this thing called Facebook? And why do we seem to be tied to it so much? So let's start with Beth. What do you think about this? Why is Facebook so overwhelming, so popular? Clearly people like and use it, Beth, right? But why? We also hear the nightmare stories about how its effect on people, particularly preteen and teenage girls. We don't seem to be able to live without it, but how do we live with it? And what's the skinny, the good, bad, and the ugly? And Dave, you get ready, because you're on deck concerning the information side and library science side of this. What does it mean in our spaces? So I'm going to sit back and learn something from Beth. What do you think, Beth?
Yikes. Those numbers are actually, when you told me they were pretty bad. And I mean, and I've given some lectures on this, but it's been a few years, right? So like even hearing the numbers now versus 2015, it's really very shocking. I will be the first to say that I'm addicted to Facebook. I have it open on a tab pretty regularly. And even really kind of when I'm disengaged, there's like moments in time where I'm not posting too much, but I still do have it open and I do scroll through it quite a bit. I don't use the app on my phone. I go to the web browser and I do that so I don't get all the notification. I can't handle those kinds of things. But, you know, I have to say I'm really on there a lot. And there's been some moments where I've had some like detoxes where I've, you know, deactivated my account and gone on breaks for a little while. And I didn't know if I could do it, but I made it through a week and even I think a little bit longer than my goal. And why did I come back? I use it all the time for work. You know, I think about, I was trying to finish a journal article on Saturday and I could not remember this information theory that I had read 10 years ago and asked a question. And Dave, I think you responded and Karen Fisher responded. And it's like all these amazing information behavior professionals, you know, that helped answer that question for me. And, you know, I think the other reason for me and why I'm addicted to it, is that I've had to live away from my friends and family, you know, since 2009. And so I didn't join Facebook until I knew I was going to leave New Orleans. And when I knew I was going to move to Seattle to get my PhD, I really started worrying about how I was going to stay connected with my New Orleans people, you know, especially having, you know, just gone through Hurricane Katrina kind of, you know, a few years before that time. And so for me, it really became a lifeline in connecting with my community. And, you know, when I got divorced, when I was in Seattle, that too, right, I could still reach out to my friends and have these connections and see people's kids growing up. And it seems like Facebook is less of that now, maybe, but I'm like, I'm hooked and I don't know what to do about it. And I have some thoughts about like how we use it professionally and in libraries, but I'd like to hear what I just have to say. I'm shocked by the numbers and I'm personally appalled by how much I use Facebook. So, but I'm not surprised that they have really sucked us all in, to my own horror. Dave, what do you think?
A couple of thoughts. One is it's worse than that. You know, I think, Mike, I like how you put it, which is, you know, we have a U.S. view of it. And that made it was really clear when WhatsApp went down. Yeah. And WhatsApp is owned by Meta, which was Facebook. And that WhatsApp is the crucial communications mechanisms through certainly most of Asia, a good part of Europe. And so for us, it was annoying. And for them, it was catastrophic in many ways. Right. It's also worse than that, in that a lot of the Indian users of Facebook, it's not just that they're users of Facebook. Facebook is their primary method of accessing the internet. So in the US, we sit there and go, why is everyone in India want to know what I'm eating? As opposed to them saying, we need to be on the internet so we can find information and get information. So it's slightly a different situation of how it became so entrenched in different areas. So it's a little bit more complicated than people wanting to be liked. It's also very much about telecommunication strategy and who's providing that. Which impacts libraries, where libraries, at least in the U.S., have very much positioned themselves as safety net internet access points. That is, if you can't get it in your home, you can get in your library. Well, that's not true globally. And so in some places, if you can't get the internet in your home, you're getting it through your phone through Facebook. And that's how you're being able to afford it. And so looking at it from that standpoint, one thing. The second thing that really impacts me that I think we need to think about with this is, we've talked about Wikipedia briefly on the podcast before, and in the days when Wikipedia was really first getting going, very large and useful, a lot of people said, you know, what's the threat to Wikipedia? And the answer was people losing interest. That, you know, if Wikipedia, if people decided they didn't want to go and they didn't want to add, Wikipedia goes away. Well, the same could be said at Facebook, but when you look at the business practices of Facebook and Google and many others, they've really use their business practices to prevent that from happening. So if you don't like Facebook, where do you go? Well, if you go to Instagram, right, that's Facebook. Or if you go to WhatsApp,
that's Facebook.
that's Facebook. And you know, it's, they didn't buy TikTok yet, but it's probably working on it. And so when I look at some of the regulation that's coming out, with the, you mentioned briefly with whistleblowers and talking about the monopolistic best practices, it's the idea of using all of that income to stack the deck so that the sort of rich keep getting richer, that they want to, if they're not going to invent the next cool thing, they're going to buy the next cool thing. And so that idea where it really creates this feedback loop where suddenly they just keep sucking everything in until there's not another option, I think that's problematic. The third thing, when I think about Facebook and once again, Meta, in all of this, and I think about libraries, is that oftentimes libraries treat Facebook as a marketing mechanism more than anything else. And this isn't about, you know, how do we appropriately use communities and whatever. I mean that they don't necessarily know what the cost of and what the policy violations are when they use Facebook for marketing, for reaching out, for connecting. There's some really interesting work going on at the New York Public Library where if you're using Facebook, you're violating privacy principles and ethics, that, you know, you're creating ways of, you know, the more attractive you make your library marketing information, the more engaging it is for your population you're serving, the easier it is for you to be tracked and your data to be monetized by other people. And so, you know, and we don't think about that. We think about it as, you know, it's like putting up a flyer all over so people will come in. Well, it's, but the flyer follows you home. And so I think that, you know, when I, you know, in the sort of world of how do we break this sucker apart, there's the fact that it's becoming international infrastructure. So that's a telecommunication angle, which has a regulatory policy view. You have the way in which it's trying to remain a part of your life by, if not inventing the future, buying the future opportunities, which has a sort of antitrust regulatory policy framework. And then you look at from a library where we're talking about from a marketing standpoint, and when people are using it for current awareness and creating community, they're buying into a business model they may not be aware of, which kind of has a policy framework that goes with it. But I may be approaching this nail with my policy hammer, as it were. But, you know, so I think that, you know, those numbers are big and they're impressive. But when you begin to break those numbers down into what they are, Facebook users versus WhatsApp users versus those where it's the only mechanism of connection in India versus, right? It's something where you can begin to tackle it and think about it in different areas. And I think all too often, we just sort of throw our hands up. And particularly since we're coming from a US perspective, we look at it and say, what's the big deal? I won't be able to put up my cat pictures. And it's like, wait. There's other stuff going on here that you're not aware of. And so a lot of the, why would we regulate this business? Well, because of competitiveness, because of privacy, because of telecommunications and competition acts and all these kinds of things feed into it.
And it's pretty clear that regulation of some kind is long overdue. You know, they talk about breaking Facebook up. Okay, that's one aspect of it. But another is the regulation of the privacy side and the nature of the algorithm, which exacerbates conflict and strife because that gets people going more. I mean, they would, you know, that's the irony. They would have plenty of use and they'd make plenty of money even if they did it in a little more honorable way. When you talk about them buying things that are, you know, cutting edge or about to be developed, a lot of time they do that and they just kill it or sit on it because they don't want the competition on that. And so I think most people agree, although we're seeing a lot of action in the regulation and the legal side, government control. The EU has taken more of a leading role, I think, than anybody in this, that it's clear that there needs to be some oversight shown to Facebook on that. But also, it's clear, and we've shown that with the statistics just now and some of the things that you've said too, Dave and Beth, that it's a clear monopoly. It's a monopoly like we've never seen, because it affects and controls so many people. And when it controls the internet access in a country in Africa, I mean, that's not just a monopoly of the social media, but like you said, that's a monopoly over the lifeline of communicating with the world. And so I think that it's gonna take the public globally standing up and saying, hey, wait a second, you know, we're not, so we don't want to get rid of Facebook. We don't want to, you know, all disconnect and whatever, because that's not going to solve anything. But we really need to find some mechanisms in order to have this phenomena be better managed and a little, even a little for the public good and not just in order to make money.
Well, and part of the problem that we're running into when discussing who and what regulates and such, and I think that with the whistleblower recent testimony, we found out that I think a lot of people misunderstand the business that Facebook's in, right? There's a lot of discussion about selling your data. Facebook does not want to sell your data. They never want to sell your data. They want to keep it all. What they sell is certainty. So when you are an advertiser, what they want to be able to do is say, I can guarantee you X number of people and X number of engagement. That's based on the data they're collecting. But once again, they don't sell you data. They sell you certainty. And I think that one of the things that we're struggling with, and this is put in a lot of different ways, right? It's a lot of times it's thrown up where, you know, people at the federal level, you know, they're old and they don't understand this stuff. And it's a new business model. This happened when the trains happened. It was a new business model. Right. It had things that people didn't expect when they did telegraphs, right? And what we're seeing is the idea that free, it's like free beer versus free as puppies, right? Free doesn't come free. And so when you, the traditional way of looking at monopolies is price control, the notion of to either create competition and control prices or prevent price control. Well, it's free. What prices are you controlling? And the answer is, it's not that we're looking at the wrong part of the elephant, or that we're looking at the wrong end. We need to be looking at what they're doing in terms of the market, the advertising business. We need to look at how they are controlling those different things and as a medium. And that's what's been interesting also, is watching the industry try and make an argument for self-regulation, which has not gone very well, where they say things like, don't worry, we will act. And they introduced a lovely concept that the FCC, the new FCC, FCC chair basically destroyed before she got the position in an academic paper. They said, we're data fiduciary. So in the economic, in the banking markets, you have people who are basically trying to sell you stuff. But if you have certain advisors, they are considered a financial fiduciary. They have fiduciary capabilities. That means they must invest and act in your best interest, not theirs. And Facebook and a bunch of people got together and said, well, we are going to be data fiduciaries. We're going to control and own your data on behalf, but in your in best interest. And it was pointed out that this is literally impossible, that you've set up a conflict of interest where you want to monetize the data and protect it. This is not working. And so it really is going to take, it's going to take someone to step in and think of a new way. It's not going to be, we're going to break them up like AT&T, and it's not going to be like we want common carriage rates like we did in the train system. There's going to be a new regulatory theory around social media.
Yeah, so that's one thing professionally. Go ahead.
Sorry.
Let me just summarize and then I'll.
Go ahead.
I just want to, because I try to bring it up a level so there are things we can remember, then we'll get on, because I have a feeling you're going to change things. But as of the information field, as academics, but also as people that are supposed to know something about this in the library field, one of the things that we really need to focus on, Dave, are new ways of regulation, new forms, and raising awareness of this. So
yes,
that's one good one. Okay, Beth.
Yeah.
Go.
Yeah. So I I was thinking when you were talking, like, who's going to do this regulation? And you said, you know, one of the things you said, the old people that are in charge, I don't know exactly what you said, but you alluded to, right, they, and I do worry, right, when I hear some of the people that are in Congress or in the Senate, and they're talking about how some of these mechanisms work, and they truly don't understand how this technology works. And you know, my writing partner, Melinda Sebastian, was just a congressional fellow, and she had the opportunity to work on, you know, some of the most, the latest internet infrastructure bills and write some of that as part of her fellowship. And, you know, I'm glad we had somebody as brilliant as her working on, you know, the words and the terminology around this. But I know there's not that many of her in Congress and helping out in Congress. And so I wonder, who does that regulation? Is that stuff we should be training our students to do? Is that work for librarians? How do we start preparing people that can actually think about those kinds of regulations? And then how do we get them in political positions to like actually make that happen? Because I think that's two pieces, right? Like, who understands the kinds of regulations that would work? And then how do we get them in positions to like make those regulations known? And that's beyond what I I know academically, so I won't talk about it. One of the other things that struck me when you were talking, Dave, is kind of about the reliance of Facebook as marketing. But one of the things I've really noticed lately is like businesses not having websites anymore and just having Facebook pages. And so when Facebook goes down, or like I'm trying to find information on somebody's website and it just keeps taking me to their Facebook page, I get so irritated. You know, it's not what I want. And I don't, right, I'm not logged into Facebook on my app. So if I'm trying to find that on my phone, I can't get to it because it wants me to log in, and I won't, you know, I do at least have that boundary up for myself. But I notice that happening more and more. So like, you know, as we become reliant upon this as a system, what does that mean for those of us who aren't involved? I hear my colleagues talking about ways to get students engaged, and they talk about having private Facebook groups for their students. And I just can't imagine making students join a platform like that so we can have conversations about privacy. Like it doesn't make sense at an information school. But I think and this is not the most worrisome thing, I guess, in all of the other things that we've said, but I think from a library perspective, when we say we value, you know, when our principles and our ethics tell us we value privacy, we value intellectual freedom, and yet we are completely reliant upon this platform that is actively working against intellectual freedom and actively working against privacy. And so how can we, as good conveyors of information, purveyors of information as well, how can we use that as a system and be privileging that in our own spaces? And even like right within our educational systems, right within our universities, asking people to like do that in those spaces as well, it's a problem.
Well, I think you raised just the right questions, which is, you know, when you talk about libraries or how we do some of this, a couple of things occur to me. One, however much I love and attribute most of my civics education as a child to Schoolhouse Rock, and I'm just a bill on Capitol Hill, when you look at the mechanisms that, when they function, should help us do this, right? I love this podcast, which is on the media, and they talk about different media. And several weeks ago, they were talking about social media and Facebook, and they talked about how the news covered it. And they said one of the things the news loves to cover is the doddering old senator line, right? Find someone who's talking about the intertubes and, you know, you guys do this.
Right.
And the idea that somehow this is quite literally up to 60 and 70 year old people running for office to set policy and write law, right? That's crazy. Your friend was one. These offices are full of interns and young upstarts, et cetera. But in the past, Congress uses the national academies, Academy of Science, Academy of Medicine, et cetera, to look at and do studies around this area. half. And we are, many people think of the Library of Congress as literally a big library full of lots of stuff. Half of the Library of Congress is not accessible to the public. It's the Congressional Research Service, which is there as policy researchers and sort of think tankish for for Congress. You've got a lot of folks working on this in different areas. So one, we need to, as libraries, we own the Copyright Office is in the Library of Congress. It's an office of the Library of Congress. And a lot of this has to do with copyright and copyright infringement and content creation, things of that nature. So there's some certain areas which make sense. You look at some of the policy work of the American Library Association around Patriot Act, things of this nature. There's something right. that the library should be able to be as a voice to its very local constituency to bring that together. That's a role to play. And I think that it then comes down to, you know, as information scientists, we spend a lot of time looking at usability. We spend a lot of time looking at interfaces. We spend a lot of time looking at tools and techniques. And we need to understand that all of these have a cost, a societal cost, and we need to look at that, whether it's in a regulatory framework or simply in the policy, you know, whatever it is, we need to, I think we need to energize ourselves. And I love Beth. That is a wonderful example of let's create a Facebook group to discuss privacy. We need to spend a little bit of time in reflecting in our rooms and thinking about what we've done and moving ahead.
Yeah, if I could jump in, one of the stats that I found interesting is that among younger populations, Facebook use is decreasing and going down. They do use Instagram, but they use other means. So I'm wondering if it's the younger generation that our responsibility is to make them more aware of the threat, like the climate crisis and things, and how young people like, you know, Greta Thunberg and others have really taken the world to task. And maybe it will come from the generations coming up who are, you know, social media is integrated into their lives, who will be the ones to demand new ways of handling and using this. I don't know if anybody has studied, we probably should check on this, why younger people are leaving Facebook. What is it? Is it they consider? And by the way, that the largest population of new users are older people, people over 65 and things. So Facebook is appealing to an older audience. And I think that's really an interesting part of it. I also just want to mention that the Facebook whistleblower was Frances Haugen, Haugen. And we'll put that because her stuff and what she was revealing is crucial to what we're talking about because she was on the inside and really helped to shed light on it. But to answer your question in one way, Beth, I do think that our students and our schools need to face this. At the University of Washington, you know, we have all the work on mis and disinformation and what's going on there. But I don't know if they've taken Facebook itself head on. And I think it is a crisis, maybe not quite as a immediate existential threat as the climate crisis, but it's up there. It's pretty serious.
Yeah.
So we've got about 7 minutes, guys. So just so you know.
Okay.
So Beth, why don't you jump in and then Dave?
Yeah, it's interesting to think about youth and how their social media habits are changing. I saw a meme this week that's like Facebook is where you go to talk to your grandma. And I think that if most of the users are over 65, then that meme is probably factually pretty close. And I we talked about this a little bit last time, is how people have kind of stratified how they use these different tools and platforms to reach different communities. And so I certainly see Facebook as like my calmer platform that, you know, my grandma could see. You know, I think that's certainly true in how I use it. I my cousins aren't on it. My nephew isn't on it. My younger sister-in-law talked me into joining Facebook, and she's not on there anymore. I felt abandoned when she left. And so I see this lack of like youth in this page in my own personal experiences, but Mike, I haven't read in why they prefer other platforms. But one of the things that I would guess is like, you know, the amount of engagement we have with just videos and stimulation. And so the platforms that are focusing on that more stimulating media is where the kids seem to be going. And so, you know, those of us who are in our 40s and older, we don't need as much stimulation as constant video streaming. The scrolling is enough. For the kids, maybe it's that extra stimulation. I don't know. It's an interesting thing. Yeah. I know how we are using stuff as rewiring our brains. And so I can only imagine if they've had access to that for that long, you'd need more stimulation, right?
I'm just laughing about how Beth actually literally used the phrase the kids. The kids.
The kids.
And so, the kids.
I say
the kids,
that's
they
what
love
I call my class, the kids. The kids.
Yeah. Well, I will tell you what's really interesting, and I'm a big fan of YouTube, but the only major social media platform of any kind that beats Facebook in terms of overall use is YouTube. And YouTube is used by 81% of U.S. adults. And Facebook is only 70%. So, but I think that YouTube is a very different animal, and it comes across differently, but I think the YouTube social media is more TikTok, right? And right. And Instagram too, which is again Facebook. But I think we're onto something. You know, I think there's also the coolness factor that, you know, younger people don't do what older people do, and there's always a new thing coming around. Sure. But I do think that having another one of our jobs, and I'll put this on the list too, is to raise awareness from the information science and information school perspective, information and libraries to do that, about this problem of Facebook and also the reality of Facebook. Because I mentioned it in the last podcast, I don't think that most people know that when you post something on Facebook, it doesn't go to everybody who is your friend, that it's manipulated by Facebook in a lot of different ways. And I think that's something interesting that we could do. And one way to do that might be through a bunch of short videos. You know, last time I did is my awesome library thingy, something called Biblium, if you remember it. It was Jenna Hartle at Toronto. Well, I've connected with her. It's no longer called Biblium because I couldn't pronounce it. It is now Infidio, Information and Videos, and rebranding it. And she and I are teaming up and doing a few things on creating those 15-second, 30-second videos about information topics for everyone. And she's really doing it. I'm just kind of advising from the sideline, but she's fantastic. And she's one of us. And that's something that I see, reaching out and helping her and others in our field to reach out. Why don't we produce TikTok videos about these very topics and find ways to make them go viral?
We got to get on the TikTok.
Yeah.
Applebee's and two, four. All right. Yeah. I think one of the things that we as the information field, the library information field, need to learn is that privacy is not a binary phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it sounds like it's coming out of left field, but stick with me for a minute, because the kids these days, early studies that looked at social media uptake by youth, there was a large narrative going on in the early 2000s when all this was just sort of getting going. And that was that children were giving away their privacy and they had no idea what was happening. And then they did studies and these children were going, I'm giving away my privacy for the functionality. I'm in essence using my privacy as a currency and I am buying this functionality with my data. And you can talk about how well-informed or uninformed or long-term that decision was. It was, however, a rational one. And I think that part of why libraries have not done necessarily very well in this environment is they keep talking about your privacy, your privacy, your privacy, and not looking at privacy in a much greater fidelity. You know, something simple as way back in the day of, I like to look for books in Amazon. Why? Because it tells me what books I've already bought so I don't do it again. Why doesn't my library catalog do that? Privacy, privacy, privacy. And the answer being, if you keep looking at it black and white, you're giving up functionality needs. You're preventing people from learning and making decisions in this environment. And I think that one of the things that we need to look at in these different contexts, regulatory, educational contexts, et cetera, is we first must investigate and adopt a much more in-depth, a much more complex concept of privacy in this world. I mean, by the way, the other side is just as bad. In other words, there are people out there, privacy is dead, give up privacy, this whole concept is gone. I'm not there, and I'm not, privacy is all or nothing. It's in that gray space, and it's in that gray space that Facebook is thriving. And we can argue that's because they're going way too far in one direction or another, but to simply say, oh, that's a gray space, we're not going to go there, or your privacy's up, is not going to help us have this conversation. So I think we do need to be, and Mike, to your point, I agree completely. We need to not simply study these tools and mechanisms and write lovely papers about tweets and things of that nature. We need to use them and to some degree master them and to understand that as they may manipulate us, how can we use them to make positive impacts, positive manipulation of different communities as well. And you know, even in academia, we see this all the time, which is, oh, I'm not on Facebook because, you know, that's not where real academics lie. It's like, well, yeah, they kind of do these days. And how can we use it for this environment or that environment? And how we set policies. There's a huge amount of universities setting policies, social media policies, which tell faculty what they can and can't do basically with the branding of the university, and not nearly enough of what do we do with trolling? What do we do with threats? What do we do with outright attacks through social media against academics of all sorts, but particularly academics of color and particularly female academics? And that we need to have policies for the university that doesn't say, oh, how we use copyright, but how do we back these people up and protect them when they're being attacked in social media? So, you know, that means we have to know it. It can't be that the communication office of the university is the one that knows about TikTok because that's how they're recruiting. It has to be the provost's office. And who's better to inform that than information scientists that need to look and understand?
Yeah. Beth, last word on this for tonight?
Oh man, I thought that was a good last word.
That's okay. I won this one. You won the what's up. We're all good.
Yeah. I think that's good. I think Yanni can cut. Okay. Mike, you can wrap. I mean, that's great.
I'll wrap it.
I
can wrap it up with a couple of things that feeds off of Dave, and then we'll take a short break. But Dave, I agree with you a lot about the non-binary aspect of privacy. And in fact, that relates to most things. When people say social media, oh, I don't do it, or I all do. Like Beth, you were a little apologetic in a way. I'm glad you're on social media and on Facebook and using it. It's not an either or. It's not binary. It's not black and white. And that's really important. And the other thing, it's not just policy. I think it's behavior that we have to talk about. It's our behavior and our students' behavior and other people's behavior. And I think libraries do have a role to play in helping people to be aware and also to perhaps to put forth best practices. That if you're going to use social media in a certain way, these are some best practices and that we can do. So. Maybe that's a good way to tie it up. We're going to take a short break. That was awesome. as we move on to the awesome library thingy. And also so people know that in our next podcast, we're going to focus on the next area of social media use, and that will be more like the TikTok and YouTube kind of thing, and the production side of the house. So Yanni, we're gonna take a little short break.
Would you TikTok?
Yes, absolutely. My granddaughter though won't let me connect to her TikTok channel. And she's really good at it. I've seen some. Yeah.
Use Facebook to talk to your grandpa.
I do. Yeah, I do TikTok for elders. I use the confidentials in the paper. It's all good.
All right. We're going to have to cut it here. And Yanni, give us a little music so we can catch our breath. And we're going to come back with our awesome library thingy. Take us out for a little while. Okay, we're back. And after that discussion, I hope you're still with us. That was, revealing and also upsetting, which is what podcasts are supposed to do, I think. So we did okay. So we're going to move on to our final segment, the required awesome library thingy. This is where we identify something in the library and information arena that we each consider awesome. So Beth, what do you got? What do you think about awesome library thingy for this episode?
So I have two. So I saw a Washington Post article that was from today that focused on how librarians and libraries were passing out coronavirus tests, COVID tests at their different locations. And I saw a few different articles. Huntsville is doing it. Syracuse was doing it. Baton Rouge, Nashville, DC, lots of cities. So I can't really pick one library to celebrate, but I know lots of them are doing it. I think that's great. We need to get COVID tests out. But then I'd also like to give a shout out to Kelly Jensen's article that was in Book Riot this week that said it's titled Public Libraries Aren't Essential Services. Now, you know me, and you know that I do believe that libraries are essential services, but I do really think we need to think about what does it mean to have our libraries open when our staff isn't well protected. And I really appreciated the first line of her article, or the first sentence and a half, and I want to share it with y'all. Library workers can't self-care themselves out of systemic problems. But in a world where public libraries have become a catch-all social safety net, little is being done to ensure frontline workers are being protected themselves from continuing to operate within our new normal. ... The article goes on. And I appreciated that she positioned the new normal. I thought that was really appropriate for our podcast, but really in how our policies and our government/administrators, managers are letting down our frontline library workers in terms of protecting them in this time. We need to get tests out to the community. And I think it's great that the libraries are doing that. I don't want to see us doing that to the detriment of our own people. So it's a kind of a two, both sides of the coin. I think it's great that we're doing it, but we really need to think about what we're doing in our libraries right now. Dave, what awesome library thing do you have?
Well, every so often I like to stretch my old school creds. And so this one is going to appeal to absolutely no one, but I found it extraordinarily interesting. And it's old, but it just came up to mind because Karen Snow has been on this committee and updated. Karen Snow is a fabulous professor, Dominican, working in the areas of information organization. And she was pushing out, she just came up with an article, which is about a code of ethics for catalogers. And so catalogers, for those who may not be in deep, they're the ones who come up with the records. You look up your book and you find out who the author is and you find out the title, and that's cataloging. And a former model of cataloging in our field is something called the Anglo-American Cataloging Rules, number two.
AACR2,
which came up with all these rules. And there's always been the sense of that cataloging is being unbiased and all this other kind of stuff. And so I was really fascinated that that librarians from the American Library Association, from the Canadian Library Associations, from the UK got together and came up with ethics. And when you look at these ethical rules, just to read a few of them, we catalog resources in our collections with the end user in mind to facilitate access and promote discovery. We commit into describing resources without discrimination whilst respecting the privacy and preference of their associated agents. We acknowledge that we bring our biases to the workplace. Therefore, we strive to overcome personal, institutional, societal prejudice in our work. If you go through this, there are 10 of them. There, the word unbiased is, I read it one, in which case it was dismissed. That idea of we take responsibility for our cataloging decisions and advocate for transparency in institutional practices and policies. We insist on diversity, equity, and inclusion in the workplace. We promote education, training, equitable pay, fair work environment for everyone who catalogs so they can continue to support search and discovery. It's quick. Beautiful statement that I think, you know, cataloging is a long, deep tradition in library science. And I was just absolutely blown away when I read these ethical statements, because they really take on the complexity of the environment now. And they do it in a way that I think is very sensitive and thoughtful, and gets away from the basics of we only write what's in the book, we only describe it in this way, et cetera. And it comes down to, we're having a conversation with the materials in our communities about how we find it, and we need to do that in an ethical way. And here's some ways we think about doing it. So it's, you know, I know a lot of time I'm talking about, the people I talk with are sort of in the reference and public service and community engagement world, but it's been absolutely fabulous to see what's going on in the information organization and cataloging world about trying to really bring these code of ethics into today's more complex and diverse environment. So that's mine. How about you, Mike?
Well, you're not going to believe this. I'm actually going to do my awesome library thingy to Google. Yes, that company, that search engine, Google. And what it is Google's programmable search. Dave, you are probably familiar with Google programmable search. Well, you know, no. Dave, remember a few years ago, you and I were trying to do an alternative search engine that had to do with librarians. Well, it turns out that you could customize your own search engine with under up to 10 websites using Google. And it just exists. It's an easy way to do it. You could do it. I did it in about 15 minutes. I started to create a credible consumer search engine for myself of the consumer tools that I like to use and consumer websites. I had also my credible websites search. I called it CR-ED, CRED. And it was Wikipedia and YouTube. And so you can do that. And I started just thinking, wait a second, you know, maybe I'm onto something here. And then I went and looked around. And of course, librarians have done this and used it. There's something called RefSeek with a asterisk after it. Dave, you know RefSeek? No? Well, people should. We'll put it in there. It's a credible search tool that uses Google. And the paid listings, the ad listings, are much more visible and identified. And then you get to the others, because I've been very frustrated, frankly, with my Google searches lately, because they're all paid listings. And we've been searching for furniture here and looking for reviews and different aspects and whatever. And it's impossible to get away from the paid listings on that, just like it's impossible on Amazon these days to get away from sponsored products and find other products, right, because that's how they monetize. Well, it turns out that RefSeq, and then there was another one called Infotopia that was done by Michael and Carol with a C-A-R-O-L-E, Bell, which is, and they have one called Kidtopia as well, which are, they've used the Google capabilities of programmable search to create more customized and less noisy search tools. And so I think it's really kind of nice that Google provides that. Now, I'm sure that Google uses this information, don't get me wrong, and that there's something nefarious perhaps going on in the background. But the point that every individual or library can create their own customized search tool. And now you have to be careful because it searches the website that you put in there. And if that website is like I went to Consumer Reports, well, Consumer Reports, the website itself doesn't have any content. It's a landing page for putting it. It won't search then Consumer Reports. But some of the others it was will very nicely. And so even if you just want a search engine that does just Wikipedia and YouTube, you can create that. So I thought that was kind of awesome and interesting. I'm going to play with it more. And it brought me back to our attempt to find a credible search tool that we can use without all the noise of Google. So that's my awesome library thing. Over to you, Dave.
There you go. That concludes our diatribes for the evening and our attempt to sound relevant and hip to the kids. Thank you for listening and for dealing with the painful nature. And if the kids are listening, we're sorry. Thanks to Yanni from Ace Chicago Events, our producer and sound guru, Ace Chicago Event Production Services, including sound, lighting, and photo booth in the Chicago area, or online, virtual, and streaming at acechicagoevents.com. Thanks to the iSchool at the University of Texas and support, and for the Syracuse iSchool as well. Please subscribe to us, rate us on Apple, iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or Facebook. No, I don't think they can anyway. Anywhere, wherever you listen to this podcast, please share a review. Very important to get the word out. Contact us if you have ideas, if you have complaints, if you have recipe ideas at info@libraryslead.org or our Facebook group, Libraries Lead in the New Normal. Our website is at www.libraryslead.org. And with that, we always say all hail and hit to the music. Good night, folks. Thanks so much.